This is West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Earlene McMichael. Coming up, Gordon Evans explores the issue of online freedom and privacy with Richard Stallman, president of the Free Software Foundation. But first, I sit down with Cherie Thomas, the newly appointed executive director of Kalamazoo's Douglas Community Association. The Douglas, an outreach center, has been on the upswing after experiencing funding issues years ago. Cherie Thomas started in mid-December. Welcome once again to WMUK.
Thank you.
You're a familiar face here in the city of Kalamazoo.
I've spent the majority of my career here in Kalamazoo with the YWCA of Kalamazoo, approximately about 14 years at the YWCA. I'm also a board member of SHARE, the Society for History and Racial Equity, formerly the Black Heritage Society.
And you used to be the board chair of that organization.
I was the board chair. Also, you know, I participated in a social justice project that was held at Kalamazoo Valley Museum, Voices for Social Justice. In Kalamazoo, that's what I do. I participate in civic activity, making sure that we're providing equitable services for all members of our community.
Let's go back to the Kalamazoo YWCA, where you spent the bulk of your career. You left with the title of Director of Women's Violence and Housing Services. You were also a consultant and a facilitator on topics concerning diversity, cultural competence, and domestic and sexual violence. Tell us about your work at the Y.
At the YWCA, I held a number of different positions, but with the last position, I ran the domestic violence shelter, the transitional supportive housing program, and the permanent supportive housing program there, making sure that women who were survivors of domestic violence, intimate partner violence, sexual assault were able to have safe, affordable housing while they were healing from their trauma.
Can you talk to us a little bit about how that work that you did at the Y is going to be helpful to you in your work at the Douglas?
Absolutely. Well, one of the things that we don't often talk about are the root causes of trauma. At the Douglas Community Association, we have the Frederick Douglass Recovery Center. And the Frederick Douglass Recovery Center provides counseling services. It provides trauma-informed groups for men, women. We're also going to be starting in February groups for boys and for girls to address those underlying causes that we see in behavior problems that arise in school, in their community activities, and in their family lives as well. And so while working at the YWCA, we dealt a lot with families that were broken, that were dealing with trauma. And particularly those youth weren't getting the services that they needed in order to be able to address the trauma that they were experiencing in their lives.
The Douglas Community Association provides a lot of social services. Originally, when it was founded in 1919, I guess you all just celebrated, what, your 97th year?
Correct.
It started as a recreational hall for African-American soldiers and veterans during World War I and II. And, and like you say, it was named after Frederick Douglass. Can you give our listeners a sense of what's under the roof at the Douglass?
Your listeners may be aware of the fact that there's the Amapau Branch Library located under the roof. There's also a branch of the Boys and Girls Club. But there are also other nonprofits that provide valuable services, such as Mothers of Hope, the NAACP. There is a Michigan Works Path program located inside. There's also a music program for children as well. The county comes once a month and does STD testing, HIV testing. Once a month, third Wednesday of every month, we provide food distribution through a partnership with Loaves and Fishes.
And the budget right now, does it stand in and around about $800,000 or is it more?
That is correct.
Than that? This is not your first time at the Douglas. You were a program manager there. What was the nature of that work?
One of my jobs was to bring in additional programming, making sure that the youth and community members had access to other programs that are offered in Kalamazoo, but bringing those things into the community so they didn't have to leave the community to access those things. So, for example, the Air Zoo came in and offered programming, connecting with the Nature Center, connecting with the Kalamazoo of Institute of Arts to bring programming directly to the community for the community.
Where are you a native of?
Toledo, Ohio, born and raised.
And you actually obtained a number of degrees there from the University of Toledo, I believe.
Yes, various degrees. So
yeah.
I have an associate's in corrections. I have a bachelor's in liberal studies with a concentration in women and disability studies, a master's degree in liberal studies with a concentration in diversity and multicultural studies, and I also have a certification in diversity management. Now, the evolution of those degrees is what's most interesting. They're more interesting than the degrees themselves.
Talk about that.
So when I talk about equity, you know, I think about my own life experience. And when I first went to college, I wanted to be a psychologist. And I unfortunately had an advisor who was not very diversity minded, who told me that was not an option for me and listed out these options, right? And so corrections was one of those options, 2-year degree, right? That's the path that I took. However, I had a quarter left. We were on quarter systems at that time when I found out that that was not the truth. And I found that out because I was assigned a new counselor who, you know, told me that if I wanted to do psychology, I could have gone into psychology. They actually had a pre-psychology program, 2-year degree. So I ended up with this associate's in corrections. And I actually had an opportunity to teach parenting classes and domestic violence classes in a correctional facility. And during that time, I knew that working in a correctional facility was not something that I wanted to do because I saw too many people who looked like me behind bars. And just the despair that was present and the hopelessness made me know that this was not where I was supposed to be. Where I was supposed to be was in a position to help people not end up in those places. And if they did, provide a route for them to actually be sustainable once they were released. And so when I got my bachelor's degree, I chose my bachelor's degree because I was actually employed at the YWCA in Toledo, Ohio at the time. And women and disabilities was an area in which I saw great need. I saw lots of women coming in who were disabled due to the trauma of domestic violence. And many of those women were women of color. Likewise, you know, when I got my master's degree, I was working at the YWCA at the time when I started that journey. And, you know, just the number of people that I ran into who were disenfranchised simply because they were people of color, simply because they were women, simply because they did not have access. And, you know, I felt very strongly, and I say it's my calling, you know, that I actually do servant-based work. I have to do work that is going to make a difference in the community. And if I'm not doing that, then I'm not on my job.
Well, speaking about being on your job, you're now at the Douglas. And before you got there, you know, it had encountered, you know, kind of a bump in the road back in and around, I don't know, about the early 2010s in terms of its finances. It had owed, you know, more than $100,000 in back taxes, and a lot of the major donors had withdrawn their support of the organization. But it has rebuilt, and my understanding is the finances are in the clear, everything is good right now. And so it's moving forward. Tell me, what is the future plans? I don't know if it's a fair question for you who just got in this position just for a few weeks, but I imagine the board might have articulated to you at least some things that they would like to see.
Well, I'm very fortunate in that I am coming in behind Sherry Thomas Cloud, who did an amazing job of making sure that the debt was cleared. She did a really phenomenal job of assuring that, you know, some of the trust was rebuilt with a lot of the donors. And so they're really excited to see what we're going to do and to be on our journey of transformation. As far as the direction that we're going, we are really, I think you're going to see a lot of programming that is really social justice focused, more deliberate in getting the word out about how everyone can participate in creating an equitable society. One of the things that is a major goal of mine is making sure that the Douglas is a building in which it's always full. one of those buildings in which I have to say, okay, or we're closing, it's time to go. You know, really assuring the community that this space is their space. And creating a space, you know, not only where we're, you know, creating programming to uplift the children, but uplift the families as a whole. Douglas is known for, you know, the youth programming and also, you know, the social and recreational programming. People can come in and, you know, rent the community room and spaces for events and things of that nature. But you're going to see a lot more of Douglas-based events coming.
Moving forward, how is it that people from the community can help?
One of the immediate needs, you know, is just community support. If anybody wants to come and volunteer, there are ample volunteer opportunities. You know, I believe that when you have a space that sits right in the community, for the community, it's great if the community can help upkeep that space. So there's, when the spring comes, there's a community garden. So I will be looking for community members to help maintain that community garden. We, you know, are going to be looking to repair the parking lot. So if anybody wants to participate in that venture, be it assisting in fundraising or, you know, donation of supplies, that would be wonderful as well. Anybody that wants to be involved in directly working with the youth, spending time tutoring the youth, providing activities for the youth, that is an option for them. If people just want to come and sit and assist with the food drive, we do the food distribution every month. There are going to be those existing opportunities and more opportunities to come.
Cherie Thomas has an idea to provide role models for African American youth.
One of the things that I'm working on right now is a new group for young men of color, and it is entitled Douglas Young Men of Promise. And the Douglas Young Men of Promise is really, really new. I have one founding member right now. And this group is going to focus on young African American men recognizing and understanding what internalized racism is, systemic racism, and how they can work to overcome and actually create change within their community for their community to be the community that they desire it to be, and to help them achieve the promise, whatever that is for them. The age range for this group is 12 to 25.
And when you say, I'm sorry, when you say the promise, not the Kalamazoo promise, but just the promise of what their life goals might be.
You got it.
Okay.
So the goal will be for this group of young men to actually be in connection with other men, mm-hmm. other African-American men who are in various career paths, you know, be it education, be it a trade, be it entrepreneurship, but who may have had some struggles along the way themselves, who can connect with these young youth, share with them their own history, connect them with information about their history as African-American people, the positive things that have been done and the contributions, and their responsibility to themselves and to their community to make it better.
When do you hope to kick that off?
We're in the recruitment phase right now. We're hoping to kick it off in the spring. And then once it's up and going, you will hear a report back, because that's part of the process, is for them to share with the larger community what this program is doing for them and how important it is for them. And to actually create a platform for young men to be heard. There isn't often where we get to hear from young men, particularly young men of color, the positive things that are happening in our lives, the struggle, but then all of the good. We hear so often about, you know, all of the negative things that are happening, but we don't talk about the good at the end. We don't talk about sustainability of that good. We don't talk about how we wrap around and support the good. The majority of the youth that I've come in contact with this last month and before, they're all really good kids. They just have some struggles. And they need us to wrap around them. I'm a firm believer in the village. And the Douglas is a village. And because we are a village, it's our responsibility to take care of the other members of the village.
We've been talking to Cherie Thomas, who started on December 19th as the new executive director of the Douglas Community Association. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
For a longer version of this interview, visit WMUK.org. For West Southwest on WMUK, I'm Arlene McMichael.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Richard Stallman says that users control a computer program, or a program controls its users. Stallman is the president of the Free Software Foundation and will speak at Kalamazoo College on Monday. His lecture is called Computing, Freedom, and Privacy. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi.
Let's begin with what exactly you mean by free software, because it does not mean that you get it without paying for it. There's a big distinction here. Explain what that is.
It's free as in freedom. A program is free software if it respects the user's freedom and their community. So in order for it to respect those, the users have to have control over the program. And that concretely means that they have the four essential freedoms. Freedom zero is the freedom to run the program however you wish for any purpose. Freedom one is the freedom to study the program's source code and then change it so the program does computing for you the way you wish. Freedom two is the freedom to make exact copies of the program and then give them or sell them to others when you wish. And freedom three is the freedom to make copies of your modified versions of the program and give or sell those to others when you wish. The first two freedoms, to run the program and study and change it, they give each user separately control over the program. But this is not enough because most users are not programmers and they don't know how to exercise Freedom 1. So, especially for the sake of users that are not programmers, but for the rest of us as well, we need collective control over the program. The last two freedoms give us that by giving us the freedom to exchange copies with or without changes. And that makes it possible for a group of users, formal or informal, to exercise control over what that program does. And in the group, some will be programmers and they'll write changes. But all the people in the group are deciding together what they want and what they don't want.
So for those of us who are not computer programmers, how would you explain to us that our freedom is threatened if software is not free in the ways that you describe it?
Well, first of all, it's an injustice if someone else decides what the program does when you use it. It may be inconvenient for you. It may be nasty to you. In fact, it probably is doing something nasty. So that's two levels of injustice. First, just that you have no say over what the program will or won't do. Even if you're a non-programmer, if you want to change badly enough, you could pay a programmer to change it for you, but not in a non-free program. In a non-free program, you haven't got the plans, so you can't get a programmer to make changes for you. The programmer has no way to try to carry out your commission. With a free program, the programmer could change it for you. But the second point is, the second injustice is that a non-free program is probably developed with malicious functionalities to mistreat the users. You see, because the developers of a non-free proprietary program have power over the users, the power corrupts them. They know about their power, and thus they give in to the temptation to put in malicious functionalities to do things like spy on their users, restrict their users. Many programs have digital restrictions management, or DRM, meaning they're designed to stop users from doing things with the data that they have. And then there is also censorship. Apple and Microsoft have imposed censorship of applications in their app stores. And Google does it to some extent also. And then there are back doors where they can give commands to do nasty things to your computer. For instance, in Amazon's ebook reader, the Amazon Swindle, there's a back door for erasing books. Amazon can send a command to erase any book. We found out about this in 2009 when Amazon erased thousands of copies of a particular book in an Orwellian act. And the book that Amazon erased was 1984 by George Orwell.
How much privacy can one expect in the digital age with the current infrastructure which we have for computing and software?
Basically none at all. They're constantly working on tracking people more, and that's an injustice too. But proprietary software is typically designed to track users. And the data, once accumulated, will be misused. It can be misused intentionally by the organization that collected it and accumulated the database. It can also be misused by rogue employees, the way employees of Uber decided one day to look through the data and find everybody that used Uber cars to have a one-night stand. And also to find out where celebrities were going. But it can also be, the data can also be misused by thieves that steal the data. It can also be misused, and this is the worst danger of all, by the government, and especially under the rule of the troll, who is in favor of more surveillance and in favor of torturing people. You can't expect a human rights to be respected in any fashion. So, really, it's dangerous to allow data to be collected, which will all be available automatically to the U.S. government under the Pat Riot Act.
Yeah, I just want to make sure our audience understands, when you're referring to the troll, you're referring to President Trump.
Well, we shouldn't say his name because that gives him gratification. The troll is a narcissist and will do wild, upsetting things just to make people talk about him and say his name. So it's better not to gratify him by using his name. And also, there's an unjust law called the U period S period A period P period A period T period R period I period O period T period Act. It's an acronym. So we can split it up into words any way we like. I sometimes call it the USAP at Riot Act or the Pat Riot Act, because in a country dedicated to freedom, there is nothing less patriotic than such a law.
And you wrote an article for Wired Magazine, which was entitled, "How Much Surveillance Can Democracy Stand?" Are we getting close to the point?
Withstand, I think it is. We have far too much surveillance, and democracy is in danger. And millions of people have been intimidated by this surveillance. After Snowden showed us how much snooping on us our government was doing, the rate of access to some Wikipedia pages, such as bomb, terrorist, Al-Qaeda, went down by 20%. Now, the people who were intimidated, they're not terrorists. They were just curious to learn about these topics. But they were afraid of being tracked in accessing those pages. The point is, they didn't have anything to hide, but they had reason to be afraid. We all must fight to preserve the ability to communicate privately and to meet with each other privately, because someday there's going to be something you'd like to say to people privately. And if all privacy has been stripped away from us by then the day you decide you want some, there'll be nothing you can do. And the reason that surveillance threatens democracy is that democracy depends on dissidents and whistleblowers. Democracy means the people control what the state does. But in order to control it, they have to know what it is. When governments do things secretly, to have democracy, to practice democracy, we have to find out what those things are, and that depends on whistleblowers. But the government calls whistleblowers criminals and makes excuses to put them in prison. Obama ramped up the war on whistleblowers, prosecuting more whistleblowers than in the entire previous history of the United States. So if it's too dangerous to be a whistleblower, the danger is there won't be any. If the government knows who talks with whom and who goes where, it will be impossible for journalists to talk with sources privately, and whistleblowers are sources for journalists. If the journalists can't conceal who their sources are, the whistleblowers will be imprisoned and we will not be able to control the state.
Should we be as concerned about private companies' surveillance, for lack of a better word, as we are about the government's? Are those two things linked or are they separate issues?
They're almost the same. You see, whatever data the companies collect is immediately accessible to the state under a, quote, national security letter, unquote. This is what the Pat Riot Act did.
So what do we do as consumers if we want to go out and explore things on the internet, but at the same time, we are trying to maintain as much privacy as we can?
Well, that states a certain priority. You see, you've assumed that being a, quote, consumer, unquote, has higher priority than privacy. I think that's backwards. If you want to maintain any kind of freedom, first of all, don't think of yourself as a consumer. Think of yourself as a citizen. Think of yourself as engaged in activities that can have political importance. Don't focus on just what you're going to buy, above all. Now, I do various things to maintain my privacy. First of all, I pay cash. Aside from airline tickets, I haven't used a credit card in years. And the reason is, I'm not willing to let a company find out who's buying what. Not when it's me. So I don't buy anything over the internet. I might find it convenient to do so, but it would be an offense against my freedom, and therefore I can do without it. There are occasions when somebody else, somebody who normally does buy things over the internet, will get something for me and then resell it to me. This way, I'm not giving up any information, and I'm also not responsible for pushing that person to do non-private transactions because it's someone who normally does it already. Another thing is I don't identify myself to websites, and I browse through Tor or other anonymizing mechanisms so that they don't know who's visiting. So I do a lot of things to protect my privacy.
Richard Stallman is the president of the Free Software Foundation. He will speak Monday night at Kalamazoo College. Links with information about Stallman's address, his work in advocacy, and a longer version of this interview can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.